When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. One of the first members of Albert Zamaha's family, introduced in his memoir, Concepcion, An Immigrant Family's Fortunes, is his uncle Spanky, a baggage handler in San Francisco's airport. Spanky emigrated to the United States from his home country, the Philippines, where he lived a very different life. As a rock star, one of the founding members of VST & Co., one of the country's most famous bands. That's just one of the family members Albert Zamaha profiles in Concepcion, published by Riverhead Books earlier this year, which traces the lives of generations of Filipinos and Filipino-Americans trying to find a better life for themselves, navigating the ups and downs of American society and politics. We're joined again by Helen Lee. Helen, would you like to say a few words about yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Helen. I am a freelance journalist, previously based out of Asia, but now relocated back in the States. And I'm really excited to be joining this conversation today with Albert.
Albert Zamaha is an investigative journalist and inequality editor at BuzzFeed News, whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Village Voice, San Francisco Weekly, and the Riverfront Times, among other outlets. A Whiting Foundation creative nonfiction grant recipient, he is also the author of Never Ran, Never Will, Boyhood and Football in a Changing American Inner City, which was a finalist for the 2019 Penn ESPN Literary Sports Writing Award and winner of the New York Society Library's 2019 Hornblower Award. In this interview, the three of us will talk about immigration, U.S.-Filipino relations, class, and how that all relates to the immigrant experience, both in general and regarding the many members of Albert's family. So, Albert, I want to start maybe with kind of an obvious question, but what drove you to kind of write about your family and so many generations of your family?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm really glad to speak about this. I think it was as I got older and got to the age my elders were when they migrated to America, I think I became more and more curious about that decision. I think growing up as a child of immigrants, I was very much immersed in that classic immigrant mythology of always moving forward to the better place, leaving behind a troubled land for the exceptional nation, the promised land. And so it kind of come to take for granted the difficulty of the decision they must have faced in the moment and all the forces that led to their decision to leave the Philippines for the United States. And around that same time, you know, I was seeing that my elders were struggling, that they hadn't escaped a lot of the financial setbacks that they experienced during the 2008 crash. And I think that all just forced me to reflect on whether this was indeed the best place for us, whether it was the right decision for us to leave what had been middle class, upper class circumstances in the Philippines for a more working class existence in America, and why we felt the need to leave in the first place.
So could you maybe run through, again, kind of big picture, some of the history of about the immigration from the Philippines to the United States?
Yeah, it's a long, long history. And if you want to go all the way back to the first Filipinos to end up on North America, it was the deckhands that worked on the Manila Galleon during the Spanish colonial era. The earliest known Filipinos to make it to the U.S. were people that jumped ship in Acapulco, made their way east, and ultimately landed in New Orleans, which was the site of the first Filipino settlement in the U.S. Fast forwarding through a lot of colonial history, once the U.S. took colonial control over the Philippines in the early turn of the 20th century, they gave Filipinos special status, that while they were closing the doors to other Asian immigrants, a process that started with the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s, because the Philippines were the territory of the U.S., they got special treatment. And so they were granted visas to study in the U.S. They were granted visas to work in the U.S. And in fact, because America had been excluding Japanese, Chinese, and other Asian immigrants, they had a labor shortage. And so Filipinos were often the people who filled those labor shortages. So that was sort of the first wave of Filipino immigration into the U.S. But the wave that eventually brought my family over was after World War II, when the Philippines is an independent nation. The first of my bloodline to make it to the States was my grand aunt, Caridad, who got a visa because she was part of the underground resistance, fighting the Japanese occupation for the Allies. She got a job with the Army Veteran Administration's Department. They transferred to San Francisco. She married another Filipino immigrant. They bought a house that now continues to be in my family. And my grandparents, though, they could only watch from the inside. They could only watch from the outside because it wasn't until 1965 that the doors opened for Filipinos and every other immigrant group outside of Northern and Western Europe, with the passage of the Immigration Act that eliminated race-based quotas. That's when my grandparents got their visas and began the process of moving our entire family, my mom's generation, to the States.
Thanks for giving us a rundown of that dynamic and family history. I wanted to ask a question about kind of the writing process, since we're going to dive a little bit more into the different stories. Sometimes writing about family, at least for me as a writer, can be a strange space, headspace, emotional space. It can feel sometimes, it takes courage to write about family in an intimate way. When you were first approaching writing this book, were there any sort of mental hurdles that you had to overcome? Or what was your mind space initially that gave you the environment to write about family?
Yeah, I think the biggest hurdle was figuring out what my own role as a narrator would be. My tactics or my approach for writing about my family, I wanted to just use the tools I already had in my toolbox, the tools I was most familiar with just from, you know, a decade of being an investigative reporter. You know, I've written about many other people's families. I've shared and reported on intimate details of traumatic and joyful and dramatic events in the lives of other people. And so to sort of shift the gaze to my family in some ways felt quite natural, because it was like, if I'm going to tell other people's stories with the sensitivity that their stories require, I can simply apply that lens to my own family. And I already sort of had the tools for knowing, how do we address complicated topics? How do we write about people in ways that they can feel both honored and represented accurately? Obviously, there's more complicating factors, because with my family, you know, if I'm writing a story about someone else's family and they end up hating me because they don't like how they came out, you know, that's one thing. But I obviously didn't want my family to hate me after the story came out. So it does kind of linger in the back of my mind. Am I making sure I'm doing them justice? Am I making sure I'm fact-checking and running everything by them? So that sort of adds one sort of complication, the fact that there is a long-term relationship I intend to maintain with my elders and cousins and my mother moving forward. But I think the more complicated question narratively was how to inject myself, because I'm really, you know, I'd been unfamiliar with writing in first person. I was all about pointing the lens at other people. So to kind of figure out how to develop my own voice as a narrator, and to what degree I wanted to be present as a guide for the reader. That was a process that just evolved over time as I slowly realized that this story was less a story about immigrants and immigration, and more a story about the second generation and about the children of immigrants and about the aftermath of immigration. And I think once I came to that realization that this was a story about the second generation, it became much more clear to me that the perspective, the fundamental perspective, had to come from me and my cousins and my generation, looking up, looking backwards at our elders.
And we do have a question about kind of the second generation experience, but I want to kind of go back to talking about your elders first. Especially your parents' generation, obviously there's your mother who becomes a flight attendant, travels around the world. There's obviously your uncle Spanky, who is a rock star in the Philippines, and you go through kind of his experience being a rock star, but then he decides to move to the United States. I guess, why did your parents' generation kind of make the choices they did to leave the Philippines and go to the United States? And then how did they grapple with life in the U.S. once they got there?
I think the roots of the decision stem from the mythology of America, you know, that their parents grew up in schools designed by Americans with American teachers and American textbooks, and they were raised on stories of America as the exceptional nation, as the nation that welcomes immigrants, that provides opportunities unavailable anywhere else. And so they were raised in an atmosphere where even when they were successful, even when my grandfather was an attorney and my grandmother was an accountant at the Philippine Central Bank, and they had a bunch of maids and drivers and a boat, they still were setting their sights on America. Which, you know, I think when I was growing up, I had sort of assumed that they had just left because of the dictatorship, the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship. And while that played a role in making conditions worse for them and leading to a bit of a financial decline during their years there, it was only once I began to report out my family story that I learned that that the plans to leave the Philippines were set in motion even before Ferdinand Marcos became a president and became a dictator, because it was just the way they were raised. It was sort of just this expectation that this is the next step in the ascent of any family, of upward mobility. And I think by the time they got here, you know, it wasn't that they expected it would be easy, right? I think most immigrants understand that they will be having to withstand a setback. They will have to start fresh in a new land. And I don't think they came in naive. I don't think they came in starry-eyed, even though they had high hopes in America. I think they came in expecting it to be difficult, but I think it ended up being more difficult and more complicated than they knew. Because I think that's just the nature of understanding America, right? That was like for me and my cousins growing up in a country where the stories in our textbooks and the stories we were hearing in presidential speeches did not align with the stories we were hearing in the hip hop songs that our favorite rappers were singing, or the backstories of our favorite athletes who had come from underprivileged circumstances and faced lifetimes of oppression. But for the elder generation, you know, none of them have any regrets. I think all of them, you know, they remember what the old country was like. They remember having to pay bribes at the airport and at customs, and the dangers they felt that they had to put big walls on their compounds. They remember the stratification of the Philippine class system, and I think those difficulties from the old countries linger in their minds, obviously much more vividly than in my mind, in the mind of my generation, because we didn't grow up there, right? There is only one country that we know, and it's America. And because we grew up here and are able to see the country from the inside out, it gives us, I think, a clearer vision of skepticism for the country, because we don't have an old country to compare it to. We don't have a mythology to compare it to. We only see the country in front of us and see the challenges that it has posed for our elders. So for them, I think their perspective is one that, you know, they came here for their children. And now that they see their children ascent into a modicum of stability, to them, that is a success. But I think to those of us in the second generation, where we sort of have to live with effectively guilt, that the cost of our comfort came at the expense of the sacrifices our elders made, it raises the questions in our mind: why was it necessary for them to sacrifice in the first place? Why did they have to leave in the first place? And I think the answer to that question, as I unravel and kind of investigate in the book, is that the country we came to played a big role in creating the conditions that led to the troubles in the Philippines, whether it was the disinvestment in the agricultural sector or the cementing of a aristocracy or the propping up of a dictator. The country that we ultimately placed our hopes in is the same country that in many ways compelled us to leave the Philippines. And I think that is ultimately the great irony of our migration story.
Great. I wanted to delve a bit into the opening chapter where you write this unique sense of fear that can come from, quote, having wholly different understandings of reality with your mother. And this is something you gradually discover over the years. You talk about like the role of faith and religion and trust in your understanding of it all, kind of culminating into a difference that you see emerging with an understanding of reality. Can you describe what that fear can feel like and specific examples where, you know, we like stories here that you found to be very specific to you or maybe quite universal to your audiences?
I think the fear is rooted in helplessness. You know, I think it's rooted in knowing that the country that has given me my benefits has also taken away from the comforts of my elders and my mother in particular. And I think, you know, my mother's a descent into QAnon conspiracy theories and support for Donald Trump, while in one way, you know, it was something that opened my eyes to really what was the scope of her sacrifice, right? It wasn't just a financial sacrifice, but it was an ideological sacrifice that she had, you know, gotten so deep into the dark heart of this country on my behalf that she had sort of come out the other side and kind of taken on so many of the ideologies about this country that I disagree with. But I think part of the fear is the fact that, you know, she's not a rogue figure, that she represents this wide population of people who believe in the same thing that she does, and sort of reminds me of, you know, that this is not this promised land that we were promised. This is not necessarily the destination point, but a country in the midst of a long running battle for its own soul. And I think a lot of the fear stems from the question of, you know, how do we make the sacrifice worth it? You know, if our elders sacrificed to come here, and it turned out that this country wasn't the promised land we expected. And, you know, I mean, the moment that I think was really hard in my mind was kind of that those months, there was kind of the summer stretch last summer before the election, when things really felt like they were fraying in America. And I think a lot of America's bones were exposed and a lot of the seams of our society were exposed, where we saw that workers had no social safety net and private interests and corporations had, you know, a disproportionate power over the lives and survivals of so many masses. And we were barreling toward an election when we weren't quite sure if democracy would hold. And I remember overhearing conversations amongst friends who openly wondered if we were going towards a civil war or a coup. And there were just a lot of scary moments in that time. And I remember almost half joking with my friends, like, where would we go if we had to leave? If we had to leave America, where would we go? You know, would we make the same decision as our elders and leave for another country? Would we stay and fight for the country that our elders had given to us? Those were the sorts of questions that I think we never imagined asking ourselves growing up in America. And then when January 6th happened and the insurrection of the Capitol in D.C. Happened, it kind of raised those fears again and the questions of, you know, had we sort of come to a place thinking we were stepping into this peaceful paradise, but actually stepped into this long running centuries old war between kind of the two sides of America, you know, the side of inclusion, the side of exclusion. It's not really one that goes away. I think it's one that sort of hovers in the back of your mind. But it's sort of reality that you have to accept, that this is my country. This is what we signed up for, even if we didn't know it. And now we have to face the question of, do we kind of hold the line and fight for the country? Or do we play this dangerous hopscotch of trying to figure out, well, what's the next best country? What's the next best country? And bouncing from place to place until we eventually find some utopia that obviously doesn't exist.
Oh, boy, I feel like I can relate a little bit to the anecdote you just shared. I remember when January 6th happened and my sister and I were talking about, we have relatives who were posting on WeChat about like how these are not Trump supporters, like them being the real Trump supporters. And no matter what political party you're in, I think what's really noticeable is the information streams that our elders receive and the realities they construct within those technological like ecosystems is different than the ones that we receive. And so in the end, I think I brought up, you know, certain points with trying to smooth out the conversation, talk about it, why they hold these beliefs. And my parents just straight up told me, like, don't talk about it to avoid conflict. And I think that's really hard because family, essentially, they're supposed to be sort of held together. But instead, you feel like you almost have to censor yourself around the people that are most close to you. So I appreciate you sharing that story and writing more about that. I want to talk about, like, so you talk about developing the sense of asking more questions, and but you also have I can sense a huge sense of respect for the elders. Where and when did you develop this sense of asking more questions about the understanding of America in your life, or the relationship between the Philippines and America? Was it in school, or was it when you embarked on your journalism career?
I'd say it was even more recent than that. You know, I think embarking on my journalism career, you're sort of taught, or maybe I wasn't taught this. Maybe this was just sort of the expectation I set for myself, but it's the idea that, you know, to be a useful journalist, you have to focus on others and not focus on yourself. And so in some ways, I'd actually actively, consciously ignored my own family story and my own sort of personal experiences. And it wasn't until really the past few years, you know, I think the more I saw my mom hit financial struggles, the more I saw my uncle hit financial struggles, and the more I saw that this was just sort of a status quo and not a temporary setback, it just made me think about their pasts and made me wonder how they felt about the state of things, especially as my cousins and I, in many ways, validated their hopes. I began to wonder how they reckoned with that distance between their downward trajectory and our upward trajectory. And I, you know, it didn't surprise me when they said that, you know, this was the whole point. But I wanted to know more about sort of what that decision actually looked like, you know, and what, whether it was an easy decision, when it was a hard decision, all those things that go into like the migratory journey. And I think from that initial curiosity of just wanting to know more about the lives of my elders, who I'd heard, you know, I knew my uncle was a rock star. I knew he was in a band, but I didn't really know how famous he was until like I would hear from other Filipino friends who grew up in the Philippines. They're like, "Oh, Spanky Rigor is your uncle? No way!" Like it was just kind of as I got older and older, and my curiosity would just gradually increase. And I'd had sort of this vague idea in the back of my mind that I wanted to eventually one day explore the history of my family. You know, I knew all these characters existed. If I had to pinpoint the moment I first, that kind of that seed of curiosity was planted, I'd say it was in 2009. It was after Cory Aquino died, and I was in college and I was writing for this free community weekly paper called Philippine Headlines in Sacramento. And I pitched the story on my granduncle Tomas Concepcion, who was a congressperson and an artist who had been part of the revolutionary efforts against Marcos and had known Cory Aquino and Ninoy Aquino and was friends with them. So I kind of wanted to do this. I wanted to visit him. He lived in Italy, in just north of Rome, where he had his art studio. And he was kind of my first access point to the history, because he had written down in his own memoirs these kind of ancestral trees that traced back to our lineage as sultanates, a part of the Sultanate dynasty in Mindanao in the south, and even before that, towards our history as part of the Maranao tribe in northern Mindanao. And it was while I was there interviewing my granduncle for this story I was writing that I learned more about that history. And I had no idea that we used to be Muslim, you know, several generations ago, and that I didn't even know we were from Mindanao. I just kind of traced our history back to my great grandparents, and you know, who had moved to Manila, but I hadn't really thought much about anything before that. So it was my granduncle Tomas that had really opened the door to this vast history that I knew so little about. And it was while working with him on the story I was writing, and then I eventually began helping him on the memoirs he was working on before he died. That entire process, I spent two trips with him, about like 3 or 4 weeks combined over these two trips, where we got really close and we spoke a lot about our family history. That really laid the foundation of curiosity that would continue to build until I eventually began this book project.
So you've talked about kind of financial struggles. You've talked about, kind of what members of the elder generation have to go through. And so I'd like to talk about class a little bit. And you quote one of your relatives, Jed, kind of early in the book and, explicit language warning, blah, 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 where you quote Jed, where he says, life was much easier back there. We had fucking maids. And you kind of, and as you tell the story, you know, several members of your family are upper classes, maybe even just part of the Filipino elite. The people they worked with became politicians. They stayed in the Philippines, became very clearly part of the elite. Yet when they moved to the United States, they have financial struggles. They're kind of struggling to pay the bills. They work as, they work in service jobs. They become part of the, let's say, well, they're definitely in the class structure of the United States, kind of lower on the ladder than they would have been in the Philippines. And that's not unique to your family. I think a lot of immigrants have this where you need to have a certain level of resources to make the move in the first place, right? But then they move to the United States where they're kind of lower down on the class ladder. So how do you think class kind of meshes with our understanding of the immigrant narrative, or how we differentiate between national and kind of global inequality?
Yeah, it's a really good question and a really interesting point. I mean, right, it's a cliche, right, that everyone's met that the Egyptian cab driver that used to be a doctor in this country, or the guy that runs a food stand who used to be an engineer, and the fact that those certifications don't transfer over. I mean, I think it reflects colonialism, right? Like, I think a person from the UK who is a doctor in London comes to New York will have a much easier time getting certification to be a doctor in New York, right? But it's often people from developing countries. We call them developing countries, but when we say developing countries, what we really mean is formerly colonized countries, right? That's why they're developing, because they were undeveloped by colonization. And so it's people from formerly colonized countries that come here and have to face the setbacks. Whereas oftentimes people from more developed countries, from colonizer countries, will come here and they'll be able to kind of have this seamless transition oftentimes. And I think that's just kind of rooted in this global caste system, racism of kind of the European colonial age that continues to linger today. And I mean, to your point about what does this sort of say about the role class plays in how we think about this stuff. Immigrant narratives are sort of predicated on the idea of sacrifice, right? And you made the point that oftentimes it's the immigrants who are able to make the jump in the first place are the ones that have the money to buy the plane ticket and withstand that impact. And so what happens is it's kind of the system we have in place today where people from formerly colonized nations feel compelled to withstand a setback in order to be of a lower class in a colonizer nation. I mean, this is widening the gaps of inequality between people from the side of the colonizers and people from the side of the colonized, right? Like there's two different ways we can see the system working, right? The system working could be that people, that families like mine don't feel the need to leave their countries and can live very happy, fulfilling, comfortable lives in their homelands. And if they leave, it's because it's a voluntary thing, not because they feel compelled, not because they feel they have to climb somewhere, but just because they want something different. Or the other way it can work is if people, you know, are in a country that is troubled and that they have to flee from, that the places they land will support them and will allow them to transition and not have to really start over from scratch the way we do in this country and many other countries that take in refugees and other migrants. So the way the immigration system is structured now reflects this system that widens global inequality in a way that benefits the colonizer nations while being a detriment to people from formerly colonized nations.
So I've definitely noticed this in the past year or so. There's a rise in, quote, like quote unquote, the Asian American experience, whether it's news coverage, book coverage, TV coverage, it seems like there's a tide rising and a lot of people are jumping on this train. Do you personally have any theories on why that's the case for you personally? And more importantly, because this is something I think about sometimes too, what are your hopes, but also sometimes critiques about this rise in this quote-unquote Asian American experience? And it's really popular now. It's like a buzzword.
I mean, I think it's two things. I think part of it is the numbers, right? Is that to be this interest in exploring hyphenated identities is a very second generation interest, right? Like immigrants want to assimilate, right? They want to come over and become American, and in many ways might come thinking their foreignness is a stigma. So oftentimes it's a second generation that was born American and doesn't have to worry about their birthright and doesn't have to worry about assimilating because we grew up, you know, as products of our country. And we're curious about wanting to know our histories and our pasts, and knowing that there is no such thing as an just American, that you are a something American, right? That's what we're sort of, that's the paradigm in which we naturally, that we naturally understand coming of age as a person of color in America, is that you're not just American, you are something American, right? We all had classmates asking us, where are you from? What are you? You know, and like, what do you mean? And you have to be like, where did your parents come from? You know? So this is just something that's internalized, that we have to figure out, who are we beyond just being American? And I think the numbers wise, you know, those of my generation, we're the children of the great wave, right? Our parents came when the gates opened up in 1965 and changed the physical face of America. And so now there's just so many more second generation immigrants from formerly colonized nations from Asia than there were 100 years ago, 50 years ago. So I think there's a numbers thing where there's just a wave of second generation people from Asian countries whose parents came from Asian countries that are interested in exploring their past. And I think the other element of that too is we are just in a moment in American history where we are interested in reckoning with our past, right? Like I don't think this AAPI exploration movement is disconnected from the Black Lives Matter and Ferguson movements and the 1619 Project movements, where we are at a moment where we are reckoning with how we came to the state of America today and what that means for all of us and how we are not that we are not the sort of white male country that our founders intended when they wrote the Constitution, but a much more cosmopolitan, multicultural, diasporic society. And what does that mean? In terms of what my hopes are for that, my hopes are is that in the future, we don't have to use terms like Asian American. I feel like the term Asian American is a term used out of yearning, out of vacuum, out of absence, right? We use the term Asian American because we have to unify our collective powers, because as individual Filipino or Chinese or Korean or Vietnamese or Persian or whatever Americans, perhaps we don't quite have the power to move the needle or to speak for ourselves or to have any sort of political influence, and that it requires us in many ways creating this somewhat arbitrary group, right? Like the Filipino experience, in a lot of ways, is much more similar to the Mexican experience, the Mexican-American experience, than it is with the Chinese or the Vietnamese experience, much less like the Indian experience or any experience of Middle Easterners, right? Like Asia is such a wide, sprawling, diverse continent that is sort of just defined by lines drawn on maps by people long before us. But we were forced to create this unified identity because we were all just sort of newcomers and we needed to forge a strength in numbers. And so we needed to create these bonds across our different ethnicities and across our different histories, right? We do not necessarily share much of a collective experience before coming to America. And then coming to America, that's in many ways where our collective experience as Asian Americans begin. So I think the formation of that term Asian Americans. The idea of Asian Americans was one formed by necessity, right, out of pragmatism, because it was something that we had to define ourselves with once we were in America. But I think in the future, and I think, you know, I try to apply this when for example, our style guide, when we're writing stories at BuzzFeed, we try to limit using the term Asian or Latin as much as possible and speak specifically, you know. Are we talking about, you know, Chinese communities? Are we talking about Guatemalan communities? And I think sort of the future of how we think about identity and how we think about what it means to be in this melting pot is one where we think specifically about those collective experiences of specific diasporas and ethnic groups and recognizing how different those experiences can be from one another.
I really appreciate your style guide at BuzzFeed then, because I'm not going to lie, Albert, I've gone on this journey related to, quote, my Asian American identity. You know, I grew up not really knowing I could claim the term American because my parents were of the sense like, oh, you're never going to look like them, so you're not part of them. So for a long time, I thought I was just, quote, Asian, whatever that meant in the English language, right? And then I went to college and my roommate was from mainland China, and suddenly I was like, oh my God, I'm so different than her. And that's when I claimed the term Asian American. But then later on, I realized it's a term that's sometimes even weaponized within the community itself. And there's a lot of settler colonialism within the Asian American community, quote unquote. And as a writer, I've realized the best pieces of writing that I resonated have been books like Minor Feelings by Kathy Hong Park or Pachinko by Min-Jin Lee, because they're so specific to the point where it's universal. And I, you know, I'm cautious about generalizing. And I know a lot of Asian Americans are also taking this time to like corporatize the identity too, or like, you know, it is the time, right? And it can be controversial, but right now I'm in this like mental phase where in my head, I will take on the identity when I see it as appropriate, and I will also let go of it when it is appropriate. And I know identities are created by humans for a specific purpose at a specific time. And me as a writer, I will try to be as specific as I can so that I do not speak on behalf of people. I also, you know, liberate myself when I am specific. And that's the point of view that I have. I have a very complicated relationship with, quote, Asian American identity. And I know Nicholas also grew up as like an Asian American outside of America often. So, yeah, I'm glad you're exploring it in this book, because there is no universal. And that's why we need more books to tell all the nuances so that everyone can pick at the library, not the one book, but one of the many books that has those stories.
And it's such a luxury to not have to carry the weight of representation. Like if I had written this book in like, I don't know, 1872, it would have been like, oh, here's an Asian American book, right? But because I'm writing this book today, where there are not just many other books by people from Asian diasporas, but many books by Filipino writers, words that I don't have to sit here and speak for every Filipino American out there. I can just speak for my specific experience. So it's like, my book is not a Filipino book. My book is a book about growing up as a Filipino in the Bay Area whose family came from Mindanao, you know, and to be able to narrow that down as much as possible. As you said, Helen, it creates for a much richer writing experience and reading experience, but it also signifies the progress we make in representation, where it's like, I think we sometimes think of sometimes there can be this fear about crab in a barrel mentality, where it's like, is there only enough space for, you know, one person of this type? And I think the progress we're seeing is that space is growing, and there's enough room for every experience. I think my favorite line in my book was that my family's experience is but one thread in a vast tapestry. And it takes a lot of pressure off to not have to feel like you're speaking for everybody.
So I have one more question, and I want to end with the Philippines. You know, you return to the country to write your 2017 article for BuzzFeed, kind of looking for right and wrong in the Philippines, kind of talk about the popularity of Duterte in the Philippines. obviously we're kind of coming to the end of the Duterte administration. And I wanted to kind of ask kind of how have the members of your family, the people who you talked to for the article, or just people like that, what's happened in the Philippines over the past 5 years for people like them?
You know, I think it's the Duterte era has been so interesting to watch from afar, because I think it, my efforts to understand it, in some ways inspired the book, because my efforts to understand it showed me how distant I was from the Philippines and how little I understood about what it's like to live there, and how my own expectations for what it means to be in a functioning society and what progress looks like is very unique to my own American centrism. And so in the Philippines, you know, folks I speak to who are, I mean, I think Duterte is obviously a very polarizing figure, right? Where the people who love him are very vocal about that, about saying he's, you know, one of the greatest, maybe the greatest president the Philippines ever had, and has brought much change, lower crime, you know, eroded systems of corruption that seemed inevitable. Whereas the people who don't like him point out that he's a tyrant in many ways, an authoritarian who has silenced the press and specifically targeted journalists like Maria Ressa, who have pointed out the flaws of his, you know, the murderous aspects of his regime. So it's complicated, right? Where it's like when I think about even the people I talk to who find that Duterte is an authoritarian who is driving the Philippines toward a really dark dystopian future, will concede that one benefit is that they no longer have to pay bribes at customs, or that they no longer feel scared walking outside at night. And many of them still feel that way, even though they will say that the Duterte presidency has been a failure on balance. But I think the challenge is that in a country where the problems are so deeply rooted, it becomes hard to measure what does progress look like, and what costs have to be paid to achieve that progress. As we do come to the end of the administration, like I don't know how to think about it. You know, I feel like I am not much closer to understanding the sort of role Duterte will be playing in the long arc of Philippine history than I was 5 years ago. You know, I think history will show that his efforts to combat corruption were perhaps not quite as successful as it might have seemed early on, that a lot of the systems he promised to undermine were not as wiped out as it might have seemed like was going to happen early on in the tenure, and that at the end of the day, he will leave office with the country in not much of a different state than when he stepped in, except with journalists facing criminal charges and many people dead from a drug war that doesn't seem to have had much benefit to the country. That's the long answer. The short answer is I don't know. I haven't been back there in four years. You know, I think the old me, I think if you would ask me this question in 2015 or 2016, before I took that reporting trip to the Philippines at the start of his term, I would have given you a much more confident, clear-minded, sophisticated answer about what Duterte means for the Philippines. But I think after reporting on it over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years now, the thing that's become clearest to me is how little I know and how little I can understand. Because at the end of the day, I spend my days thinking about America, and I spend my days thinking about how American policy affects my life and the life of people around me than I do, frankly, thinking about the prospects of the Philippines, right? Other than reading some newspaper headlines in the morning, I haven't set foot in the Philippines in a few years, and I'll talk to people about what they think about Duterte, but I know better now than to have any confidence in my diagnosis of a country that I know much less about than my own country. But I will be following the election closely, and I hope to write about it, and I hope to see what happens with Robredo, with Pacquiao, with Sara Duterte, Bongbong Marcos. I mean, it's the cast of characters, like the thing that I think I'm most interested in seeing this time around is that historically we've seen that political dynasties, run the Philippines, and that the only times somebody has beaten a political dynasty is when they're a celebrity, like Joseph Estrada, and you know Manny Pacquiao now hopes to fill that position. I'm gonna be watching this election more as an observer than as an expert.
So with that, thank you for listening to the interview with Albert Samha, author of Concepcion and Immigrant Families Fortunes. A couple final questions, Albert. Where can people find your work, and what's your next project?
Yeah, albertsamaha.com, albertsamaha. That'll just sort of have a archived compilation of my books and my writings from various places. Next project, I have a few ideas, but I don't really know. You know, maybe I'll explore the other side of my family tree. Maybe I'll do something entirely different. I've got a few ideas in mind, but I'm going to give myself the next 6 months to a year to kind of let things simmer, hit a little reset, do some reading for pleasure, now that I don't have to read a bunch of history research books, and kind of let my mind wander. I'd like to explore my inner child for a few months before committing to a project. But they'll come. They're going to come. My goal is by the end of next year, I'd like to have a general idea of what the next book will be.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews, plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. Thanks again to Helen for joining me on the show. Helen, where can people find you?
Thanks, Nick. You can find me at Helen Lee Writes, HELENLI Writes, WRITES on Twitter.
We hope you're listening to the Asian Review Books podcast, now found on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Soumya Roy, author of Mountain Tales, Love and Loss in the Municipality of Castaway Belongings. But before then, thank you so much, Albert, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.